passes American Federal Bank versus the United States, 2007-5040. Spencer, when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just one moment. Have I used up my time, Your Honor?
What that be like? The red light hasn't come on yet.
May it please the court. The court should reverse the award of costly replacement damages, both because it was based on a hypothetical model and because the trial court adopted the model using a procedure that deprived the government of its right to a fair trial. Turning to the model itself, the trial court erred when it awarded damages on a hypothetical costly replacement model. American Federal issued stock in 1993, purportedly to replace the supervisory goodwill that had been eliminated in the breach. And it paid dividends on that stock from 1993 until 1997. In 1997, CCB acquired American Federal and canceled the stock. And the court held, and this is at A20 in the record, that that acquisition was not breach-related. So that was a break in any causal chain. Now, the court's model calculates dividend damages not only from 93 to 97, but it continues those dividend damages from 97 into the future of 2011.
Now, calling them hypothetical dividends. What's a hypothetical dividend?
Your Honor, a hypothetical dividend is one that was never paid. Your typical damage model...
Never paid or should have been paid?
Never paid, didn't need to be paid. Your typical damage model, Your Honor, compares the but-for world, as if there was no breach, with the actual world. And the difference is obviously damage. Here, what the court did was it compared the but-for world, to some extent at least, with another hypothetical world, not what actually happened, but with dividends that were never paid. And so what you have is a hypothetical world compared to a hypothetical world, and the result, of course, is speculation.
But wasn't that basis essentially saying that I'm going to give out the hypothetical dividends as if the 1997 merger never took place?
In fact, the court said that he was looking at what dividend rate American Federal would have paid subsequently had the merger not occurred. But the merger, first of all, of course, was not breach-related. But the second thing was the stock no longer existed. The company no longer existed. There was no one to pay dividends to anyone. And American Federal...
The parent.
Well, CCB, for 2 years after AmFed was acquired by CCB, it paid some dividends to its parent. After that, it was merged into one of CCB's other banks, other thrifts, and it disappeared altogether. Then CCB was acquired, and then its acquirer was acquired, all in non-breach-related acquisitions. So, and what the court found was the plaintiff's model was based on those dividends from American Federal to CCB, and CCB to its shareholders, and so on. The court rejected that model because it said those dividends were speculative. So we know that the actual dividends that were actually paid were speculative. And we know that American Federal and its stock no longer existed.
Well, it did exist for 2 years. It's a subsidiary of the parent.
It did. But what the court found and what the evidence showed was that even then, those dividends that were paid during those 2 years were not related to the breach. The testimony was very clear. This is in the record at A100-980. This is the plaintiff's witnesses. After the CCB acquisition, American Federal adopted CCB's dividend policy. So it wasn't paying dividends based on its own policy.
So is the government's position that after 1997, no dividends were paid, but damages were calculated as if they were paid, and that should not have been done?
Yes,
after
Your Honor.
1997.
Yes, Your Honor. And indeed,
previous to 1997?
Before 97, the trial court... First of all, there's $3.6 million worth of damages that the court awarded that we are not challenging. So the actual, what we call flotation costs and other costs, they were not challenged, and those presumably will stand. But as far as dividend costs and the like, from 93 to 97, those are actual dividends. We have other problems with what the court did, but those were actually paid. I don't want to hide the ball from the court. If the court cancels the hypothetical dividend, there is no further damage to be awarded in this case. The plaintiffs wouldn't get any, because basically the trial court needed the hypothetical dividends to create damages for the plaintiffs.
Wait, that's post-87 or the whole?
Post-97.
But post-97, the government also argues there's a standing issue, right? That the bank that acquired American Fed would be the one that would have to challenge this amount, and they don't have standing.
If there was damage, if the issuance of dividends at that point was damage, which we challenged, which the court rejected, it would be CCB and those subsequent people who were in some way damaged, and no, they're not plaintiffs here, so they don't have privity to challenge that.
But that would only be after 1999.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That would be after 1999, because the subsidiary still existed prior to 1999.
It did, Your Honor, but I'll give you an example. And the record shows that American Federal paid a $25 million dividend, so separate from its normal dividend, while it still existed, to assist with CCB's stock repurchasing plan. And that's in the record at A100-983-984. That had nothing to do with the breach. That was CCB deciding to purchase back some stock. And that's an example of CCB telling its subsidiary, give us money for a certain project, and money being paid, having nothing to do with the dividends paid because people purchased the stock or people had the stock from the 1993 stock sale and conversion.
So pre-97, you've got the retained earnings issue.
The retained earnings issue, Your Honor, and I'm mostly going to rely on the briefs on the retained earnings issue. But basically, if the trial court decided not to count retained earnings, there's no question, it's undisputed, that American Federal issued a capital plan. It sent a plan to the government. This is how we're going to return to capital compliance. It's undisputed that one element of the capital plan was American Federal was going to retain their earnings, not pay them out, to rebuild its capital. There's no dispute that it retained $32 million worth of those earnings and returned to capital compliance, was projected to meet all of FIREA's required based on those. And given that, you can look at it one of two ways. In 93, when they raised all this capital, they didn't need to raise really any of it, but certainly they didn't need to raise all of it. At that point, the goodwill bucket had less than $4 million $4.5 million in it.
But that was still short, because even if they retained all of their earnings during that time period, they would still be about $4 million short of their regulatory capital.
They were in compliance with the requirements under the capital plan that they'd submitted, and they were in requirement, and by the end of that year, they were in compliance with all the requirements, even without this capital infusion. So they didn't need it. What they did for business decision in 93, they decided to set out and simplify their balance sheet and to raise some more capital. It didn't have to be done. These retained earnings were mitigation. And respectfully, Your Honor, the trial court or the plaintiffs should be in a position to say, we're going to count this as mitigation and not that.
But you mentioned that there was a specific capital plan. How is this case different than home savings? And home savings, this court says, the plaintiff was allowed to keep this discrete cushion that they had said they needed, and therefore that amount couldn't be used to mitigate.
Your Honor, these plaintiffs did not have a cushion. Before they raised this money in 89, just a few months before FIREA was passed, they were out of capital compliance for the previous 6 years. They did not have a record, as Home did, of having this cushion, wanting this cushion, insisting upon this cushion. So this is a different set of facts, Your Honor. And briefly, Your Honor, I wanted to turn to the methodology by which the trial court adopted this model. The trial court created this model itself. This model was not proposed by any of the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs' experts were all rejected. And in the procedure that the trial court used, deprived the government of a fundamental right. What the trial court adopted was a 10-part model. In that model, elements of which we had never seen at trial. It's not that he took the plaintiff's model and just adjusted it a little bit. It's not like
the model. It seems to me if the government wins on that theory, you get a do-over.
Yes.
You don't win, you just get a do-over.
Yes.
You
and
you don't get back and let the court do a do-over. Is that really what the government is seeking here?
If the court gets to that, addresses the hypothetical model and reverses because of that, no, we don't need to get to the manner in which it was obtained, Your Honor. And in the same way on the sub-debt issue, which, and this was reached through the trial court's methodology, the trial court reached a conclusion about whether to count the repayment of sub-debt. I'm not going to get into the detail, but whether to count that as a benefit that they got under the breach. Our expert and plaintiff's expert agreed it was a benefit. You could look in the appendix at 201-935, that's the plaintiff's amended expert report. At paragraph 8, plaintiff's expert says, I calculated the benefit of the avoidance of principal and interest on the Series B sub-debt. The next paragraph, paragraph 9, he says he's in agreement with the government's expert. But in the trial court's model that it created, it chose not to count them as a benefit, even though all the experts disagreed with them. And so, I raise this, Your Honor, both to demonstrate the problem with the trial court adopting a model which has not been subject to discovery, has not been subject to trial testimony, which is what happened here, and to show that if the court reaches the conclusion that both the plaintiff's expert and our expert reached on the sub-debt, which is that it should count as a benefit to the plaintiffs in working out the damages. If that happens, then again, the court need not reach the methodology that was acquired because that, again, would allow the plaintiff's damages.
Well, we would only reach that methodology if we disagree with the hypothetical dividend issue.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time.
We'll say it for you, Mr. Vincent. Mr. Berger.
And please, the court, David Bergman, on the order for Plaintiff Appellee American Federal Bank. Probably start right with the hypothetical dividend question that the court raised. And I think the intention of some agreement here, I agree with the opposing counsel's statement that a hypothetical dividend perhaps is one that has never been paid. That is not this case. This is a case where dividends were paid, continue to be paid today. The replacement capital providers, they are paid by the successors and interest to American Federal Bank. We sought to recover those ongoing dividend payments.
Which I assume is in regulatory compliance right now, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
In regulatory compliance, then why would those dividends still be assessed against the government to mitigate the damage?
Well, all of the cases, you know, Holm and LaSalle Holm and others, said you measure cost and benefits of replacing capital through the phase-out schedule of the goodwill or the subordinated debt here.
So the actual cost of mitigation should be paid.
Absolutely.
So how does a hypothetical dividend an actual cost of mitigation?
Here, Your Honor, there is no hypothetical. There is an actual dividend paid. It's paid through 1997 directly by American Federal Bank. It's continued to be paid through 1999. The dividend went up with the merger with CCB. The court said that's a remote consequence. He's not going to give us the full amount of the dividend paid after 1997 because he believes it was infected by this remote dividend that increased the dividend payout.
If you're paying the dividend, isn't there a presumption that you have profits and earnings at that point in time? Otherwise, you could not pay the dividend.
I believe that's correct.
If you have a P&E, then would that be in compliance with regulatory capital at that point? You couldn't declare dividends unless you're in compliance.
I don't think that's necessarily correct. I believe you could get permission to pay dividends while being out of technical compliance. Perhaps that would be in compliance if you look at permission. That may be the case. But in all of the cases, the cost of capital has been measured by the payment of dividends. That's in Holm, that's in LaSalle, that's also in the recent decision in Bank of America.
What about Old Stone? Old Stone still requires actual damages, right?
Well, Your Honor, absolutely there are actual damages here, and they were measured faithfully to this court's precedent. They were measured absolutely consistent with the evidence that was presented. These are not hypothetical. They are still being paid today. The court ordered only a portion of them. What the court did was he froze the dividend rate in 1997. He froze the earnings rate in 1997, despite the fact that from 1990 to 1997, American Federal's annual earnings more than doubled. The court is a conservative measure, and I'm not going to assume that it keeps going up. I'll freeze it in 1997. I will not give you the actual dividend history because that is affected by the remote mergers. So, Your Honor, the court did exactly what was directed at Holm and the South Holland to use the actual dividends paid for up till the time when that's no longer be calculated with certainty. And then he did just as in Holland and South Holland. He projected the dividends that would be paid. Here it's a portion. He projected what is a portion of the dividends actually paid and being paid today by American Federal successors to the providers of that replacement capital.
What was the stock issue to the public? Was it 1988?
There was an initial going public in 1988, yes, Your Honor. And then in 1993, there was the secondary offer that provided stock to the replacement capital providers.
But the 1993 transaction was really a reorganization of this debt and subject.
No, it was also a secondary offering.
At the same time.
At the same time. And the evidence is overwhelming that secondary offering was caused by the breach. The reorganization was caused by the breach. There was overwhelming evidence that that's so. It's in the documents, it's in the testimony, and it's made repeatedly as a finding of fact by the trial court to which this court should defer.
But when you did go public and you issued stock to the public and some of the other stockholders in conversion of the debt, how is the damage incurred by American?
Well, the conversion of the debt was in 19. The conversion of the debt to preferred was in 1990. Then the preferred was converted to common stock in 1993. That was, again, the trial court found, caused by the breach. The result was that there was increased costs to American Federal.
How did that cost an increase if you issue common stock to the public and to your debt holders? Is that a real cost?
It absolutely is, Your Honor. For example, the common stock issued in 1993 in exchange for the preferred stock. The common stock, the common stock issued in exchange for the preferred stock and also issued to the sub-series A sub-debt holders, or both of a piece. Those are issuances that American Federal could have sold rather than confer on the replacement capital price, could have sold in the open market. We know exactly how much it would have cost, or American Federal would have received as a liquid instrument that the recipients could have sold.
The debenture holders had a right to convert at one time. Did they not? They had a warrant, a common stock?
The Series A debenture holders did, yes.
So how is that more of a liquidation than what would be subject to the warrant?
Well, what the trial court found is that the Series A warrants would not have been exercised until 2004. Because of the breach, they were exercised earlier, which forced American Federal to pay the cost of that capital, to pay dividends for those 11 years.
But it couldn't pay dividends unless they had earnings and profits.
Absolutely true. They had earnings and profits, and they had to pay out of those a cost that they would not have had to pay had there been no breach.
But there's no requirement that you pay dividends on common stock.
For this institution, there was a practical requirement. It was competing against its peers. There is not a legal requirement to pay a dividend on common stock that I'm aware of. There is a practical requirement here to behave like a bank. That is what the market expected and insisted. That's what the capital providers insisted on.
But are we talking about the issuance of more common stock in lieu of dividend?
Your Honor, if I may anticipate the WestFed payment in kind issue. In WestFed, the government has twice in its briefs described the payment in kind in WestFed as a payment of stock, and that's not true. In WestFed, it was a payment of a debenture, and the court found that it was a debenture of unknown value. There wasn't a ready market for it at the time, and only a potential future obligation, not knowing whether it would actually conditions necessary for payment on that debenture would be triggered. Here, we have a payment of a stock publicly traded on the most liquid market in the world, the New York Stock Exchange. This is much more similar, Your Honor, to the Bank of America case, which came out over the summer. And if I may, I'll just read a discussion there of a payment in kind, which I think controls here. It's found at 495 F3rd, 1366, at 1373 and 74. And it's under the heading liquidity dividend of about $3.5 million. And the court here, the Federal Circuit said, this issue seeks recovery for real estate transferred to HFH partners and later sold. Specifically, this issue concerns recovery for the share of the real estate was being, from the real estate sale, was being paid to the Bishop Estate, which was the replacement capital provider. The trial court held the transfer of the real estate to HFH with the payment of a dividend in time, made as a direct result of the breach. But for the breach, OnFed would not have transferred 26% of its stock to the Bishop Estate. This court affirmed the ruling that was a cost borne by the successor to the Thrift Air Bank of America, successor to OnFed Bank, and affirmed an award of cost of capital based on that payment in kind. That is much more similar to our case here. In fact, our case is, I think, an easier one. We have a publicly traded stock, and as I say, precisely known value, easy liquidity, and that was a cost borne by American Federal and a value demanded by the capital, replacement capital providers.
The 626,000 some odd shares which were issued to make up the dividends in 1993 were common stock shares. That was not a pick. That was not a payment in kind. That was really a payment in common stock.
I think I agree with that. The government that characterizes it as a payment in kind and says because it's not cash, it doesn't count as cost. It's a cash equivalent.
Well, it's a cost to whom?
To American Federal Bank, which could have sold the
shareholders of American Federal Bank, not to the bank itself.
No, well, to the bank itself. The bank itself is the shareholders. That is absolutely a cost to the bank. The bank could have sold that 628,000 shares of itself on the open market and received that capital.
If it wanted to. Well, they could have added some more shares to it and diluted even more.
Well that is not...
Is dilution a cost factor for the bank?
Your Honor, it certainly is in this instance that there are stock issued that could have been sold on the open market, and we know exactly how much money American Federal would have received, and instead it had to pay that as compensation to replacement capital providers. That is absolutely a cost to the institution. And as I say, it's an absolutely precisely known, this is not as an US Fed where it's an inchoate future obligation.
What specifically was American Federal going to do with the retained earnings? Just the record indicated that there was some specific mission?
Yes. But let me back up a moment, Your Honor, and say that before going public in 1988, American Federal had several years of success coming off of several very tough years. So in the mid-1980s, 1986-87, it's quite successful, but it's still not meeting regulatory capital minimums. It went public, converted from mutual to stock corporation at the end of 1988. It raised more than was necessary to meet bare minimum capital, and in fact established a capital cushion as a whole. Was about $27 million over capital requirements. American Federal stated to investors, investment bankers, the investment community, we do not expect to pay dividends on this stock because we are going to make sure we maintain our capital cushion and use the excess capital to grow, do acquisitions, grow organically. That was the plan with respect to retained earnings. It was followed for only about a year until the government breach, but that was absolutely the plan. Testimony and the documents, the letters, the statements and annual reports, all state that for the foreseeable future, we will not pay dividends, we will retain earnings. They were going to be a growth stock, not a traditional bank stock.
But there's no real case that's gone as far as you're suggesting we go in this case with respect to retained earnings. I mean, my concern is frankly what your opinion is. I think the facts here were differential from home savings. I think that home savings, the evidence was much more tangible and specific.
I think the court is wrong in that conclusion because I think the evidence here is very, very strong that American Federal had no intention of paying dividends, wanted to retain earnings. Before the breach, it had a $27 million capital cushion. After the breach, in 1993, with all of the retained earnings and with all of the capital raised in 1993, not just the portion of the capital of the trial court allocated as replacement capital, all of that capital, the capital cushion in 1993 was only $26 million, less than the pre-breach position.
So there is no evidence on the record with respect to lost profits or sort of opportunity costs with respect to the retention of earnings?
I think that is correct, Your Honor. As the trial court noted, the government argument that retained earnings should be viewed first as the replacement capital is brought only very late in the trial and the post-trial briefing. The position of American Federal is still throughout. That it is the secondary offer that the breach caused, and that is what we use to mitigate. Your Honor, it's hard for me to understand how it can be viewed as a mitigation to have fewer retained earnings than we would have but for the breach, which is the fact here. Another key factor here, Your Honor, is that the capital plan is clearly imposed because of the breach. It is also clear that that American Federal would not be released from the capital plan without the 1993 secondary offering restructuring. That was a condition that the government proposed to release American Federal from the capital plan, and there was no way that anyone would consider American Federal to have mitigated the harms of the breach until it was released from the capital plan.
The real issue is what the actual damages were of 1993 at that time. What were the actual damages to the bank in 1993?
They were enormous, but they were not calculated in the trial below damages to 1993. What was calculated and what was awarded were the costs of mitigation. Those costs, as in Holman and as in LaSalle Holman, extend through the amortization period of the goodwill. That is, we should be able to recover. We should be able to have the capital on our books as long as the government promised it. That's the same thing that was done in Holman, the same thing that was done in LaSalle Holman. You project the cost into the future, your present value them back. That's what this court did here. We were entitled to have the capital on our books until the expiration of a government promise, which for the sub-debt was until 2004, and 10 years beyond that for the
government. But isn't that really the determination of what the real cost of capital would be?
That is what the trial court determined, the real cost of capital. I believe the trial court did that precisely, conservatively, and faithfully with this court's precedence.
And how do you justify that on the issue of hypothetical dividends? Is that a real cost at that point?
These are absolutely a real cost. In fact, we were awarded only a portion of the real cost because of the remote, but the court trial court found to be a remote event. We were not awarded the full payments that have been made to replacement capital providers. We've been awarded only a portion of those. Those are real costs. Urge comments. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, Mr. Berger. Mr. Dinsa has some rebuttal comments.
Thank you, Your Honor. Plaintiffs try to characterize the hypothetical model as a fraction of the actual dividend. That's not the case. As the court said about the plaintiff's expert, Mr. J's calculation of damages after the second quarter of 1997 had to be discarded because those calculations reflected dividends paid by the merged entities to their shareholders or to their holding companies. That's at A5556. The court rejected theirs because it was based on the actual dividends, because they were speculative. So the court didn't then take some percentage of those and make a percentage of some speculative number. What it did was it created this hypothetical model. What would have happened if? And compared to this hypothetical but-for world, and created a speculative result.
Isn't that also premise of the assumption that the earnings would continue and the earnings flow would continue at a certain rate?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We don't have an actual world where they continue to exist. So the court assumed that the last quarter of earnings was going to be their actual earnings forever. And then, at that point, they were only paying 27% of earnings as dividends. The court assumed in the future that they would have started paying 34% rate of dividend. So it's a hypothetical built on an assumption, built on a hypothetical. No entity existed to pay these damages. The plaintiff's expert, Mr. J, testified at A101636 that AmFed no longer existed. Its shares were transformed into CCB shares after 1997. LaSalle and Home, those cases rely upon the fact that the dividends were actually paid. That's not the difference here. Plaintiffs try to create a difference between a projection and a hypothetical. They say the court projected damages. Your Honor, if I projected a baseball player how many home runs he's going to hit next year, that's projection. If I try to tell you how many home runs he would have hit last year had he not been injured, that's a hypothetical. What the court did was, it's starting in 1997, and I wrote this opinion in 2006, starting in 1997, he's telling the government, you have to pay damages on money that would have been paid had a series of facts not existed. That's a hypothetical. That's not a projection. Now,
So that's why, Vince, I couldn't find anything in the record showing whether or not the acquisition that was completed in 1997 took into account any kind of future cash flows. Because if $410 million was paid to stockholders, how's that calculated? Is there any evidence in the record? I couldn't find it.
No, Your Honor. It did result in a $170 million profit to those shareholders. It was a very, very good deal for them. But the calculation on how CCB came up with the number, it isn't. Presumably, it was based on what they thought that the property was worth based on its future.
But there's nothing in the record to show.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. To Judge Prost, you asked about retained earnings. The plaintiffs didn't seek damages on retained earnings. They didn't say these were a cost to it. That sets them apart from the home savings plaintiffs. They did seek lost profits, saying we had all these possibilities. The court rejected that. It said that they didn't identify or prove that they had alternative investment. That's why there's no damage on the retained earnings. But there's no question that they retained them. And what they want to say is, look, we had an empty bucket. It was empty because of the breach. And we got all these retained earnings, and we put them in the bucket. But you shouldn't count that as mitigation, even though we pretty much filled up the bucket. No, you should empty that out and start the bucket again. And now we can charge the government for refilling the bucket on something that's very expensive.
Moving on to another point, do you have any disagreement with your colleague with respect to his characterization of Bank of America, or Bank of America, just in case? That was in connection.
Oh, the payment account. I do, Your Honor. What the plaintiff did, what AmFed did was this. It owed some money to these preferred shareholders, and it gave them $600,000 common stock, shares of common stock. Now, what this court has held in AmFed, and in WestFed, and in some of the other cases, is the mere issuance of that common stock, that's not the cost. The time we establish a cost on the issuance of common stock is when dividends are paid. So the mere fact that AmFed gave those people common stock under this court's jurisprudence, there was no cost there, and it shouldn't have been counted against them. Later, when dividends, the court says, well, dividends are paid on that. And it also counts damages then. It sort of double counts. It counts damages when the 600,000 shares were issued, and then later when dividends were paid on those 600,000 shares. Unless there's any other questions, Your Honor, for these reasons and those in our brief, we ask the court to reverse the award of damages, and in the alternative, we ask for a remand so that we may have a discovery of your testimony on the
court's call.
Thank you.